Stop shooting, you're hooting and owl. Stuck in the drain.
Time to stay.
It's happy Friday, gracefully happy, just let rain.
Ladies and gentlemen, I shared with you some of my favorite late 60s, early 70s British psychedelia with you there, some rarities. Oliver from 1974. I just couldn't take the needle up. Heard, left it on there for three tracks from his Standing Stone LP. Flowers on a Hill, Freezing Cold Like an Iceberg, and Royal Flush. Part-time farmhand, spare-time guitarist, and full-time Robert Johnson enthusiast, Oliver recorded Standing Stone in early 74 on a portable four-track Tiak machine, just like the one I'm sitting next to here on his parents' farm in a particularly remote area of Wales. That's what happened. Just the beginning. We also heard from the legendary Morgan Bluetown label with a couple from the Ambrose Slade's breakout album from 1969. Before they became hard rockers, they were some pretty heavy psychedelic groovers. We heard from their Beginnings LP, Mad Dog Cole instrumental, leading up into Fly Me High. And the one and only Mr. Syd Barrett from 1970 on his self-titled LP on Harvest Records. We heard Waving My Arms in the Air. Josephine Baker from her 2007 LP, Hazel Eyes on Locust Records. We heard Cracker Jack Fool. Been spending a lot of Miss Lady Josephine lately. Can't keep her off of my turntables these days. Started off with Miss Clara Rockmore on the theremin from her 1975 recordings. I'm the Magic Stranger. I'm here till midnight. Happy Thanksgiving. Thank you for listening to WGXC 90.7 FM out of Akron, Hudson, Catskill, and some stranger's basement in Columbia County tonight. Coming up right now, a familiar voice. You'll know it right off the bat.
Hard! out for you. The winter would hold no spring. Couldn't hear a robin sing. I just wouldn't have a clue. If not for you. For you. The winter would hold no spring. Couldn't hear a robin sing. I just wouldn't have a clue. If not for you. Not for you.
when I was still a dilettante in the kitchen, they held my attention, even the dull ones, from cover to cover, the way crime and murder stories did, Gertrude Stein. When we first began reading Dashiell Hammett, Gertrude Stein remarked that it was his modern note to have disposed of his victims before the story commenced. Goodness knows how many were required to follow as a result of the first crime. And so it is in the kitchen. Murder and sudden death seem as unnatural there as they should be anywhere else. They can't. They can never become acceptable facts. Food is far too pleasant to combine with horror. All the same, facts, even distasteful facts, must be accepted. And we should see how before any story of cooking begins, crime is inevitable. That is why cooking is not an entirely agreeable pastime. There is too much that must happen in advance of the actual cooking. This doesn't, of course, apply to food that emerges stainless from deep freeze. But the marketing and cooking, I know, are French, and it was in France, where freezing units are unknown, that in due course graduated at the stove. In earlier days, memories of which are scattered among my chapters, if indulgent friends on this or that Sunday evening or party occasion said that the cooking I produced wasn't bad, it neither beguiled nor flattered me into liking or wanting to do it. The only way to learn to cook is to cook. And for me, as for so many others, it suddenly and unexpectedly became a disagreeable necessity to have to do it when war came and occupation followed. It was on these conditions of rationing and shortage that I learned not only to cook seriously, but to buy food in a restricted market, and not to take too much time in doing it, since there were so many more important and more amusing things to do. It was at this time, then, that murder in the kitchen began. Before coming to Paris, I was interested in food, but not in doing any cooking. When in 1908 I went to live with Gertrude Stein at the Rue des Fleuries, she said we should have American food for Sunday evening supper. She had had enough French and Italian.